The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine dated March 1st, 2013. And as usual, we'll begin with the main story section of The Week magazine. Our first article is entitled, Here Come the Sequesters, $85 Billion in Cuts. The Pentagon and the federal government were bracing for about $85 billion in automatic spending cuts starting next week, as President Obama and House Republicans remained far apart in their latest battle over government spending, deficits, and taxes. Speaking at a White House event while surrounded by federal employees, Obama called on Congress to delay the so-called sequester cuts to defense and domestic spending and negotiate a balanced deficit reduction plan. The sequester's meat cleaver approach to deficit reduction, Obama said, would cause unemployment to soar, damage the economy, and impair military readiness. The Congressional Budget Office warned that the $85 billion reduction in federal spending this year would reduce GDP growth by 1.25% and eliminate at least 750,000 jobs, including teachers, police, and private defense contractors. This is not an abstraction, said the president. People will lose their jobs. The sequester emerged from the debt ceiling standoff of 2011 when Congress approved $1.2 trillion in automatic cuts over 10 years to be triggered in 2013 if Democrats and Republicans could not forge a compromise on deficit reduction. The across-the-board cuts of 7.3% to military spending and 5.1% to domestic spending were designed to be so severe that neither party would swallow them. Obama has proposed an alternative plan of $900 billion in targeted spending cuts and $600 billion in new revenue from the closure of tax loopholes. But congressional Republicans say they gave Obama a tax increase on the wealthy in December and insist that any deficit reduction alternative to the sequester consists wholly of spending cuts. The revenue debate is now closed, said House Speaker John Boehner. Now here's what the editorials had to say. Sequestration is now inevitable, said the Washington Post. Just days before it hits, neither party has staked out anything like a serious negotiating position. So bring on the unemployment, said the New York Times. Slashing federal spending indiscriminately means fewer jobs for soldiers, Head Start teachers, air traffic controllers, and cancer researchers. Americans are about to learn the true impact of the Republican rampage against government. Don't listen to the Chicken Little warning, said the Chicago Tribune. Cutting $85 billion from our $3.5 trillion budget amounts to a mere rounding error. Our debt-ridden government vitally needs this relatively mild dose of fiscal medicine. Obama intends to make the sequester more painful than it needs to be, said the Wall Street Journal, by shutting down vital services first so the public revolts. But no one ever said cutting spending was going to be easy, and in the long run, the economy will be better for it. Now here's what the columnist said. What an absurd, discrediting way to run a government, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. Sequestration hacks away at essential and inessential services alike, be it treatment for AIDS patients or farm subsidies. Worse, it doesn't address the biggest driver of our debt, the ballooning costs of entitlement programs. Let's not forget the small matter of scuttling our national defense, said William Kristol in Weekly Standard. standard.com. The U.S. Navy recently announced that the sequester had forced it to reduce its aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf from 2 to 1. To our enemies, it's proof that America's power is permanently waning. Do the Republicans really want this fight, said Jonathan Bernstein in WashingtonPost.com. They insist the sequester was originally Obama's idea, but he's now saying he wants to avert the cuts while Republicans are welcoming them. With Congress's approval ratings firmly in used car salesman territory, it's not hard to guess who most voters will blame when the pain becomes real. It won't be just the people who lose their jobs who will be hurt, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. Our economy is finally coming back to life, but our dysfunctional government is now the biggest single threat to the recovery. The last thing we need now is another few months of rancorous political haggling accompanied by a sudden, drastic drop in government spending. If you want to see where that goes, look at Italy and Britain, now in recession. The next item from the main story section, Hagel moves closer to confirmation. Chuck Hagel seemed certain this past week to be confirmed as Defense Secretary after Senate Republicans indicated that they would end their unprecedented effort to block his nomination with a filibuster. Critics have argued that the former Republican senator is the wrong man to head the Pentagon, alleging that he is hostile to Israel, opposes efforts to stop Iran's nuclear program, and wants to diminish America's military footprint abroad, charges Hagel denies. After joining in a filibuster that prevented a vote last week on Hagel's nomination, Senator John McCain said this week that Republicans would now stand aside, even as he insisted that Hagel, a decorated Vietnam War veteran, was unqualified to be defense secretary. Fellow Republican Senator Lindsey Graham also said he'd withdraw the filibuster, but called Hagel one of the most radical choices for Secretary of Defense in a very long time. Republicans said they voted to delay Hagel's confirmation to have more time to examine his finances and past speeches. That rare move, he's only the third cabinet nominee to be filibustered in Senate history, forced Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid to schedule another vote for February 26th and warn Republicans that they were endangering national security. This isn't high school getting ready for a football game, said Reid. We're trying to confirm somebody to run the defense of our country. Since Democrats control the Senate, Hagel is expected to easily win the nomination. Now here's what the editorial said. The GOP stalling is all about self-preservation, said the Buffalo News. Senator Graham is normally a voice of reason, but he's anxious about a potential Tea Party challenge in 2014. In denying President Obama his nominee for as long as possible, the senator hopes to prove to the rabid portions of his constituency that he can be as foolish as any Tea Party congressman. He and his allies will come to regret this filibuster, said the Cleveland Plain Dealer. By jerking around Obama's nominee, they're inviting Democrats to do the same the next time there's a Republican president. But this filibuster is hardly unprecedented, said the Wall Street Journal. In 2005, Democrats, including then-Senator Barack Obama, delayed a vote over John Bolton's nomination as UN ambassador, claiming the Bush administration hadn't released enough information. The Senate's nomination protocol is far more elastic when a Democrat is in the White House. Here's what the columnist had to say. Republicans should do everything possible to block Hagel's confirmation, said Brett Stevens in the Wall Street Journal, because he is simply too dangerous to be our next defense secretary. His sympathy for Iran is well known. He opposes even mild sanctions against the regime, as is his anti-Semitism. Hagel once referred to pro-Israel groups in Washington as the Jewish lobby, and in a 2007 speech at Rutgers University, reportedly called the U.S. State Department an adjunct of the Israeli Foreign Minister's office. He has since claimed he can't remember making that comment, but repudiated it anyway, which makes him a crank who lacks even the courage of his convictions. This is a smear campaign, said Greg Sargent in the WashingtonPost.com. The conservative blogger who noted Hagel's alleged adjunct comment has admitted that the quote is not an exact word for word, and no other attendees recall the statement. It's not the first lie to be thrown at Hagel, said Eric Bollert in HuffingtonPost.com. Right-wing news site Breitbart.com reported that the former senator had received secret payments from a shady group called Friends of Hamas, citing an unnamed Senate insider as the source. Republican Senator Rand Paul called the news concerning. The one problem? Friends of Hamas doesn't actually exist. Republicans have succeeded in trashing Hagel's reputation, said Daniel Larrison in the AmericanConservative.com, but their ridiculous tactics mean that the GOP will continue to be seen as nothing more than a party of bombastic hardliners. Most Americans agree with many of Hagel's views. They're eager to avoid war with Iran and think the military should be downsized. By playing to the most extreme elements of the Republican base, Senate Republicans have ensured that all of the moderates, independents, and realists that they have alienated over the last 10 years will keep running away from them. Now from the main story section, we'll turn to the controversy of the week. Preschool. Could it close the education gap? Compared with the rest of the world, said Mary Sanchez in the Kansas City Star, we are a wealthy nation of dummies and dropouts, lagging far behind other countries' educational performance. But President Obama now has an ambitious plan to close that gap. In his State of the Union address, Obama proposed a program that would give all U.S. 3- and 4-year-olds access to high-quality preschool education. The new program would be run at the state level with federal oversight. It's unclear where the funding would come from, said Dylan Matthews in the Washington Post, but universal pre-K programs would more than pay for themselves over time. Studies show that children from chaotic inner-city homes who attend high-quality preschool not only acquire book smarts, but develop critical non-cognitive skills such as delayed gratification, planning, and cooperation. These students end up going further in school, paying more in taxes, and saving society a lot of money, with much lower rates of teen pregnancy and incarceration. Sadly, that's a myth, says Darcy Olson in NationalReview.com. Studies showing that dramatic effects of preschool were conducted back in the 1960s and 70s and involved only a few hundred students, each of whom received intensive academic intervention, costing a whopping $18,000 per pupil a year. The more realistic guide to what we can expect is the National Head Start Program for Disadvantaged Kids, which spends less than half the amount per pupil. A recent study of Head Start's 47-year-old record by Obama's own Department of Health and Human Services concluded that preschool has no lasting impact on children's future educational success. While most children do show some immediate benefits from preschool classes, the study found those gains have usually disappeared by the third grade. It's true that Head Start's outcomes are dismal, said David Brooks in the New York Times, but some state programs across the nation, including ones in Georgia, Oklahoma, and New Jersey, have had much better results. They've shown that preschool really can give children significantly better lives, but only if the teachers are well-trained and held to rigorous performance standards. The Obama plan acknowledges this reality. It gives states the flexibility to design and adjust their own programs, with the federal government measuring results and enforcing high standards. Preschool can make a big difference if it's done right, said Susie Kim in WashingtonPost.com. Oklahoma's successful program, for example, requires teachers to have college degrees and training in early childhood education and has a 10-to-1 ratio of students to teachers. That would be a hard sell because of cost, and skimping on quality to save money could undermine the entire effort. Another threat to this idea is too much hype, said Joan Walsh in Salon.com. Despite Obama's lofty promises, preschool is not a social policy silver bullet that solves all the educational and social problems rooted in poverty. Still, when preschool programs are well designed and staffed by trained teachers, they seem to be the single best intervention to break the cycle of chronic poverty. So why, then, isn't Obama focusing on at-risk kids who have the most to gain from pre-K, rather than launching a new universal program, asked Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Why isn't he proposing a smaller-scale experiment to see if preschools really do work? Here's why. Obama has such a strong ideological commitment to an expansive government that he believes he can overcome any obstacle with enough funding and top-down regulation. We know this works, Obama says, when in truth, we don't. And now from the main stories section, we'll turn to the popular column, Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for kicking the habit. After a British woman gave up cigarettes on her 102nd birthday over fears they could shorten her life, Clara Cowell has smoked 60,000 cigarettes since her first one in 1931. It was a good week for street food after Montana lawmakers passed a bill allowing residents to bring home and eat road-killed game such as bears and bighorn sheep. People hit a lot of animals, said State Representative Steve Lavin. There's a lot of good meat being wasted out there. And it was a good week for making hay after it was revealed that Hillary Clinton will soon hit the speaking circuit, charging upwards of $200,000 per speech. Her husband, Bill, gets an average of $189,000 per event. It was a bad week for Russians after nationalist politician Vladimir Zhirinovsky proposed banning overeating and excessive sex, which he blames for Russia's low life expectancy. In Europe, America, or Japan, they live longer, he said. Why should we perish? It was a bad week for Charles Maynor, a Democratic New Jersey state senator, who had to apologize for liking two unseemly websites on his Facebook page, Big Booty Freaks and You Got Knocked the F Blank Out, which features videos of physical assaults. Maynor promised to unlike the sites once his daughter showed him how. And it was a bad week for law and order after a Swedish murder suspect was turned away when he tried to surrender to Malmo police, who told him the station was closed. I'm a wanted man. You guys really want to get hold of me? Saleh Hadri told them. He was finally arrested when, as directed, he went to an open police station in another town. And now we'll turn to the briefing from the Week magazine. This week, the briefing article is entitled, The Threat from Space. Last week, a meteor exploded over Russia, and a large asteroid whizzed past Earth. What if the near miss were a direct hit? Do asteroids hit Earth often? Hundreds of them enter the atmosphere every minute. That's because our solar system contains several bands of space rocks, asteroids, and comets of varying size and composition, which can veer off into new orbits that intersect with Earth's. Almost all the objects that reach our planet are mere inches in diameter and burn up in the atmosphere. A handful of times a year, space rocks up to 10 feet in diameter make it to the planet's surface. Once a millennium, an asteroid larger than 250 feet penetrates the atmosphere, causing major but localized damage. Every 1 million years, on average, an asteroid over a mile in diameter strikes Earth with catastrophic consequences. An asteroid 6 miles in diameter is thought to have wiped out the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. If one that size were to hit Earth tomorrow, it would instantly erase all life within 1,000 miles of impact and probably throw so much dust into the atmosphere that it would block out the sun for years, killing off most species. What happened last week? Literally a cosmic coincidence, although a spectacular one, said astronomer Alan Fitzsimmons of Queen's University Belfast in the United Kingdom. A meteor about 55 feet in diameter flashed across the morning sky over Chelyabinsk in Russia's Ural Mountains before exploding like a bomb in midair about 20 miles up. The shockwave blew out windows and doors and injured 1,200 people. That unexpected blast occurred the same day that an asteroid 150 feet in diameter, designated DA-14, passed within about 17,000 miles of Earth's surface, a hair's breadth away in astronomical terms and closer than many man-made satellites. NASA estimates that there are about 4,700 similarly sized asteroids within 5 million miles of Earth, and the impact of any one of them could easily destroy a major city or cause a 60-foot-high tsunami. Well, how worried should we be? I sleep at night, and you should too, said Timothy Spahr of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. The odds of an extinction-level impact within the next century are vanishingly low, and the odds are thousands to one against even a mid-size asteroid impact. But scientists acknowledge that the risk is not zero. In 1994, Jupiter was hit by comet fragments up to 1.2 miles in diameter, causing a blast with a radius about twice the size of Earth. That was a wake-up call, said Grant Stokes of MIT's Lincoln Laboratory. How could we defend ourselves? The first step is to track large asteroids, and NASA is on the case. Congress tasked the space agency in 1998 with identifying nearby asteroids over two-thirds of a mile in diameter. So far, it has discovered 862 asteroids big enough to do serious damage to Earth. But we know little about thousands of smaller asteroids that pose a major threat. DA-14, for example, was spotted only a year ago. NASA spends $20 million a year identifying and mapping threats, and the nonprofit B612 Foundation plans to launch a space telescope in 2018 that will orbit the sun in search of asteroids. The Foundation's chairman, former astronaut Rusty Schweikert, figures there's a 30% chance the telescope will find an asteroid or comet on a collision course with Earth. If it does, the question becomes, what can we do about it? What about blowing it up? Not a good idea. Trying to destroy an asteroid with a nuclear weapon would only turn a cosmic bullet into buckshot that could pepper our planet with smaller meteor strikes. Instead, scientists hope to change an asteroid's trajectory long before it reaches Earth. Some scientists have proposed spraying one side of an asteroid with white paint, causing it to absorb less solar heat on that side and changing its course over years. Another proposal would use a shield to shade the asteroid for the same purpose. NASA says the most likely option would be using an unmanned space vehicle as a gravity tractor to pull the asteroid off course or just crashing the ship into the rock to ram it out of the way. Ramming a spacecraft into an asteroid has still to be considered the reference solution for its simplicity, said Melis Milano Vasil of the University of Glasgow. Are we equipped to do that? The technology exists, but not the funding or an organized program. A deep space mission to deflect an asteroid could cost as much as $80 billion, four times NASA's budget. It would require global cooperation, and we wouldn't have much time to argue. The closer an asteroid gets, the harder it becomes to deflect. A 2011 study by European Aerospace from Deimos found that deflecting a 300-foot asteroid becomes effectively impossible unless we act more than a decade before it hits. So if we had discovered last year that DA-14 was aimed right at us, our only option would have been to evacuate the area it was projected to hit and cross our fingers. The near miss would be a call for action, said Schweikert. We live in a shooting gallery, he said. We don't think it's a good idea to put off protecting life on Earth. And the footnote to this briefing section is the day Siberia shook. Last week's shockwave over Russia was child's play compared with the Tunguska event in 1908. A 120-foot meteor exploded a few miles from a remote Siberian forest, causing a blast estimated to have been around 185 times stronger than the one from the nuclear bomb dropped on Hiroshima. More than 80 million trees were flattened like matchsticks in a blast zone of 830 square miles. No deaths were reported, but owing to the isolated location, the first scientific expedition occurred only 19 years later. Witnesses then talked of seeing fire in the sky, but were not eager to give more detail to visiting scientists. They believe the blast was a visitation by the god Ogdi, said NASA scientist Don Yeomans, who had cursed the area by smashing trees and killing animals. And you're listening to our reading of The Week magazine here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we're going to turn to the best columns in the U.S., according to The Week magazine. Our first one is entitled, How Obama Manipulates the Media, written by Jim Vanderhye and Mike Allen in Politico.com. President Obama is a master at limiting, shaping, and manipulating media coverage of himself and his White House, said Jim Vanderhye and Mike Allen. Not because a liberal media willingly give him a pass, but because this White House has strongly cut back on reporters' access to the president, while exploiting social media and other technologies to ruthlessly control its message. The results are both transformational and dangerous. The White House press corps, which has the background to ask the toughest and most informed questions, is now denied direct access to Obama, his cabinet, and other top officials. Months go by without a real press conference. The administration, meanwhile, churns out plenty of flattering content of its own, photos, social media messages, and interviews with naive journalists, and feeds it to hungry TV and websites. Professional reporters are bypassed like never before, a tactic future presidents are sure to copy. As major media companies shed resources and wane in influence, the balance of power between the White House and press has tipped unmistakably toward the government. The next column is entitled LaPierre's Terror-Filled Dystopia, written by Alex Seitz-Wald in Salon.com. It must be terrifying to be Wayne LaPierre, said Alex Seitz-Wald. The NRA's leader demonstrated last week how far off the deep end his organization has gone, in a column arguing against any new gun control laws whatsoever. LaPierre insisted that every sane American should be loading up on as many firearms as possible, describing this country as a violent dystopia on the edge of fiscal and social financial collapse. His America is full of terrorists, Latin American gangsters, and roaming mobs of looters and rapists prowling the streets, looking for unarmed prey. Every natural disaster leads to anarchy. Hurricanes, tornadoes, riots, terrorists, lone criminals, LaPierre wrote. It's not paranoia to buy a gun. It's survival. It's a wonder the guy ever comes out from under his bed. In reality, violent crime is at a two-decade low, and in the week after Sandy, crime in the New York City area dropped dramatically. Guns, moreover, are far more likely to be used in homicides and suicides than in self-defense. But survivalists like LaPierre live in their own little world, a cold and scary place where you can't trust anyone and only lethal force can protect you. And the third column from the Best of This Week in the Week magazine, An Olympic Mistake on Wrestling, by Jason Gray in the Wall Street Journal. Olympic wrestling is down for the count, said Jason Gay. The International Olympic Committee recommended last week that wrestling be dropped from the Summer Games from 2020 in yet another money-driven shin kick to the Olympic mission. Amateur wrestling may not be as glamorous as sports like basketball, but isn't that exactly what the Olympics are about? In every Olympic Games, we get drawn into obscure sports we normally don't watch, such as curling, pole vaulting, archery, and wrestling. To these true amateur competitors, the Games are the pinnacle, and they practice their sports obsessively for years in hopes of winning a medal in the bright spotlight of a global stage. In an era of phony drama, it's a drama that cannot be faked. It's mesmerizing. But now Olympics officials prefer big money sports like golf, which returns to the Olympiad in 2016. But who wants to see another competition of famous, jaded professionals? Olympic wrestling provides a more soulful thrill as unknown but lion-hearted athletes compete to achieve their wildest dreams. Now we will flip to the back of the Week magazine for The Last Word. This week, The Last Word article is entitled Lost in Paradise. The Unification Church is trying to build a new Garden of Eden, says Monty Reel, but so far, nobody's coming. For roughly $6 a day, anyone can hitch a ride aboard the Aquitabon, a 28-foot floating market that runs a weekly route on the Paraguay River from the center of the country to its northern border. Dozens of locals have wedged themselves into the second deck. They include women and children, but most are men who scrape out a living, clearing trees and brush for small-scale livestock farmers along the upper stretches of the river. Most speak the indigenous language of Guarani, first, and Spanish, second. I'm a conspicuous outsider. Occasionally, I catch the men staring at me and speaking in lowered voices, as if taking bets on what I'm up to. They'll never guess. I'm looking for paradise. I've heard it's under construction, just upriver in Puerto Leyda. The Reverend Sun Myung Moon, who died in September 2012 at age 92, founded the Unification Church in South Korea in 1954. In addition to overseeing the church, which he said aimed to fulfill Jesus' unfinished mission by establishing a new kingdom of heaven on earth, Moon managed vast commercial interests and called himself a messiah. He was frequently accused of cult practices, in part because some of his hundreds of thousands of followers turned over very personal decisions, including the choice of marriage partner, to him. More than a decade ago, Moon told some members of his church that he wanted them to lay the foundation for a new Garden of Eden in one of the least hospitable landscapes on the planet, northern Paraguay. In 2000, Moon brought roughly 1.5 million acres of land fronting the Paraguay River. He turned Puerto Leda over to 14 Japanese men, national messiahs, who were instructed to build an ideal city where people could live in harmony with nature as God intended. Moon declared that the territory represented the least developed place on Earth and hence closest to original creation. Moon wasn't the first utopian to favor Paraguay. Examine many European maps drawn between 1600 and 1775, and you'll find something labeled Lago Xerres at the head of the Paraguay River. Conquistadors, journeying up the river, confronted the inundated plains and confused them for a massive inland sea. Tribes spoke about a land without evil on the far side of Xerres, and the Spaniards believed that the same area hid a gateway to El Dorado, the lost city of gold. By the 1800s, most mapmakers correctly recognized that Xerres as a mirage and labeled it as part of the Pantanal. Still, the dream lived on for some. The 20th century brought utopian colonies of Australian socialists, Finnish vegetarians, English pacifists, and German Nazis. They all failed. At the Puerto Leda dock, I meet a man who introduces himself as Wilson. He's not a national messiah, but a 44-year-old Chilean, a Moon follower who moved here 2 years ago. His wife and children are still in Chile. He offers me a ride to the complex. Within a minute, the headlights reveal a cluster of buildings. I can make out what appear to be several two-story houses, a water tower, a couple of large communal buildings, and a cell phone tower. Wilson kills the engine in front of a structure that looks nothing like the humble riverside casitas found throughout this region, a district the size of South Carolina, in which about 80% of the 11,000 residents lack running water. The building in front of us has a peaked terracotta roof, brick and stucco walls, expansive glass windows, and 5 air conditioning units. At the front door, leather slippers wait for us. We remove our dirty shoes and step into the Reverend Moon's victorious holy place. All is silent. Wilson flips a switch, throwing light on what appears to be a dining hall. The large wooden tables could accommodate about 100 people. They are vacant. There aren't many people around right now, Wilson explains, but sometimes we have 100 working here at once. An acetylene thin Japanese man walks toward us. He is smiling behind wire-rimmed glasses. He pads across the glazed tiles with a hurried shuffle, as if he's been waiting for us for years. He is 62, and his name is Katsumi Date, or just Mr. Date, as Wilson addresses him. He's a national messiah. So he asks, "What is it you would like to see?" "Well, I'd like to see what 12 years of dedicated labor and pursuing of earthly perfection looks like." "Everything," I answer. "The place," Mr. Date says, "is all mine." Back outside, I see huge dormitory buildings, guest houses, and sheds for mechanical repairs. I count 7 freshwater fish farms, fully stocked with pacu, a toothy species that looks like an overgrown piranha. I see no other people. "Normally, there are about 10 of us who live here," Mr. Date tells me, "but this week's 6 are away in Asuncion, so there are just 4 now." Mr. Date and I walk through early morning light on smooth sidewalks, past manicured gardens of hibiscus and bougainvillea, besides an Olympic-sized swimming pool. We enter a 2-story communal building that resembles an office complex, climb a stone staircase to the 2nd floor, and enter what appears to be a rec room. There's a television, and Mr. Date pops a disc into a DVD player. The DVD, he says, explains everything. The footage that flashes across the screen dates from 1999. We see the founding messiahs walk across untamed wastes, the grounds where we now sit. They lay bricks in wet mud. They sand metal frames. They wash dishes in the river. They wear heavy clothing, light fires to keep the mosquitoes away, and sweat in the wavy heat. They stagger through gale-forced winds. The rest of the DVD covers more recent developments. Messiahs erect the water tower. Man-made fish ponds materialize on the grounds. A landing strip is planned, flat by tractors. The messiahs unload saplings from the Aquitabon, then plant them in sprawling groves. A group of a dozen visiting Japanese students, the children of Unification Church members, help the messiahs build a school in a nearby village. The fact that only 10 men live here comes rushing back to me. The colony has actually lost population since its inception, despite all the construction. Four of the original messiahs have returned to Japan. Only the hardest of the hardcore have stuck it out. And this raises a couple of questions. Who are these guys, and why have they put themselves through this? It's noon. The midpoint is an unchanging daily regimen, up at 4:30 a.m. for a half hour of silent worship, breakfast at 5, then back to their bedrooms to prepare for work at 6:30. Each is assigned a separate job. One fishes, another tills crops, another feeds the fish in the ponds. Someone checks the pH level in the pool, though no one swims. Lunch always runs from noon to 1:30. They'll work until 5 p.m. and round out the evening with dinner and a short prayer meeting. That leaves them about 2 hours until the lights go out at 9. Most use that time to read, pray, or watch satellite TV. I strike up a conversation with Norio Owada. Mr. Owada is 64, and manual labor and a good diet of homegrown vegetables have pared him down to a taut, leathery minimum. He's a good example of your average founding messiah, a city dweller with very little experience in construction and even less in wilderness survival. His wife was selected for him by Moon, who was said to possess the ability to intuit good matches, and Mr. Owada left her in Japan with their children when he came here. He gets a church salary, which helps keep the colony solvent. His family and other members of the Japanese congregation provide more money, though no one can tell how much has been poured into the place. Once every 11 months, Mr. Owada gets 4 weeks of vacation, which he can use to go to Japan. His wife has visited him twice since 1999. In the beginning, the colonists hoped they would be joined by their wives as well as more followers. Every August, they invite children of Japanese church members to visit for a couple of weeks, but so far, none have chosen to stay on. My wife thinks that it's not realistic for her to move here yet, Mr. Owada says, because we still have to raise the standard of living more. When I press him on how tough and lonely this must get, Mr. Owada says it doesn't bother him. Moon sanctified his personal sacrifices, promising the men that spiritual rewards would make up for their suffering. Months later, after Moon's death from complications from pneumonia, I will once again reach out to Mr. Date to see if the true father's passing affects the Messiah's dedication. It doesn't. They plan to work on Puerta Leda for at least another decade. Of course, there is ecotourism potential here, says Mr. Date. We're standing outside an unfinished three-story brick building. Mr. Date refers to it as the hotel. But for the moment, its only occupant is a stick-legged baby goat nosing around the food pellets being stored on the ground floor. Mr. Date begins running down the potential pluses of opening the place up to travelers. Tourism would allow people to see examples of sustainable living and take the lessons home with them. This Eden is intended to be an environmental paradise, he says. We walk on past planted fields of lemongrass, oranges, mangoes, grapefruit, asparagus, sugarcane. The crops are struggling. If agriculture alone is expected to support the colony, there are some kinks to work out. The men have planted thousands of jatropha trees, which can be used to make biodiesel fuel, but hundreds of parrots zeroed in on them and ate all the fruit. During the most recent wet season, rising waters flooded many of the thousands of neem trees. It's been a hard year, Mr. Date admits. It's clear that these guys have faith in miracles, and that's exactly what's needed here in Puerto Leyda. Without one, the victorious holy place seems destined to be another curious monument to human ambition and folly. But watching how hard the messiahs work, I can't help but admire their tenacity. The fanaticism that underlies their devotion to this cause must burn hot, but they hide it well. They're not evangelical. They're friendly and welcoming to those who don't share their beliefs. They're reflexively humble and generous and admirably tough. They're underdogs, the kind of guys you root for. During the last hours of my visit, Mr. Date shows me something that might actually work out. Japanese yams, he announces, staring down at a plot of tilled soil. They grow very large underground, up to 10 kilograms. They do well here. My immediate impulse is to celebrate this victory with hearty congratulations. Maybe all the sweat that Mr. Date has sunk into this plot will bear a little fruit. Maybe little victories like this can help other people in the Pantanal live richer lives. Maybe that's enough. Mr. Date stares down at the dirt. Unfortunately, he says, they taste very bad. And that was copyrighted 2013 by the Mariah Media Network, excerpted from a longer article that was first published in Outside Magazine. Now we'll turn to the health and science section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first article is entitled, The Mammal That Inherited the Earth. The common ancestor of almost all mammals on Earth today, including human beings, was a furry, long-tailed, rat-sized creature that emerged after the extinction of the dinosaurs. In a six-year study that collated vast amounts of data on anatomical traits throughout the mammalian family tree, researchers discovered that all modern mammals that nourish their unborn young through a placenta, including bats, cats, elephants, whales, and humans, evolved from a single insect-eating, tree-climbing species called Protungulatum donae. This is a landmark piece of work, paleontologist Stephen Broussat of the University of Edinburgh tells New Scientist. Previous research has suggested that several lines of placental mammals coexisted with the dinosaurs, but the new study backs the hypothesis that they emerged only after an asteroid 66 million years ago killed off most of the massive reptiles, paving the way for a mammalian takeover beginning 200,000 to 400,000 years ago. The new timeline suggests that the first placental mammal is 36 million years old, younger than previously thought, says John Gatesy, an evolutionary biologist at the University of California, Riverside, a finding that will surely be controversial because it clashes with dating derived from genetic evidence. The next item is a Great Lakes crisis. Lake Michigan and Lake Huron have dropped to their lowest levels on record, threatening their shipping and fishing industries. A new report by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers found that the two lakes are 29 inches below their long-term average, lower than they've been since record-keeping began in 1918, and that more than half of the drop occurred since January 2012. The other Great Lakes, Superior, Erie, and Ontario, are also much shallower than usual. We're in an extreme situation, Detroit-based Corps hydrologist Keith Komplettowicz tells the Associated Press. The Great Lakes hold 84% of the fresh water in North America and are major shipping routes. Lower water levels damage coastal wetlands and restrict the amount of cargo that ships can carry. Researchers partly blame climate change. Years of record high temperatures have accelerated evaporation from the lakes at the same time rainfall has lessened, dredging to deepen the navigational channel of the St. Clair River, into which Michigan and Huron empty, may have also caused as much as a 16-inch drop in the lake's water levels over the years. Reducing the risk of autism. Scientists still can't explain why 1 in 88 children in the U.S. has autism, a number that's risen sharply over the past decade. But now a new study suggests that pregnant women can significantly reduce their risk of having an autistic child by taking folic acid supplements. Researchers in Norway recorded the diets of more than 85,000 pregnant women who gave birth between 2002 and 2008. They discovered that women who took folic acid supplements beginning 4 weeks before conception and continuing through the first 8 weeks of pregnancy were 40% less likely to have a severely autistic child than those who didn't. That's a huge effect, Columbia University epidemiologist Ian Lipkin tells NPR.org. The notion that a very simple non-toxic food supplement could reduce your risk is profound. Leafy vegetables, beans, and most whole grains contain folic acid, but eating a healthy diet doesn't provide sufficient folic acid to provide the protective benefits, Lipkin says. You have to take the vitamins. And from the health and science section, we'll turn to talking points as we near the end of the program here. Our article today in talking points is entitled, "The Redskins, Is the Name a Racist Slur?" Should a 21st century pro sports franchise still be calling its team the Redskins, says Judy Batista in the New York Times. The festering controversy over the Washington NFL team's name has erupted again after speakers at a forum at the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C., recently expressed disgust at the inherent racism of the name Redskins, sparking new calls for the team to make a change. In a bizarre response, the team posted a series of articles on its website about the 70 U.S. high schools that call their sports teams Redskins, emphasizing the pride that staff and players take in the name. Clearly, the team intends to resist the building pressure to surrender the name it has used for 80 years, said Mike Jones in WashingtonPost.com. We're proud of our history, said Redskins general manager Bruce Allen, and it's ludicrous to think that in any way we're trying to upset anybody. If you thought football was full of dumb people, there's your proof, said Sally Jenkins in the Washington Post. The fact that a few high schools still cling to Redskins doesn't change the fact that the word is a racial slur in the same class as Dagos, Heimies, and Krauts. Perhaps that's why the name appealed to the team's original owner, George Preston Marshall, a virulent racist and segregationist who once sneered that he'd only hire black players when the Harlem Globetrotters started signing whites. Current billionaire owner Dan Snyder probably doesn't care if he continues to insult Native Americans since they're only 1.4% of the population and are therefore too unimportant to be insulted. Absurdly, some fans and football traditionalists even argue that Redskins pays tribute to Native Americans, said Christopher Zara in IBTimes.com. Come on, it's a racist term with a violent and bloody past, coined by white settlers who would literally hunt Native Americans for sport. Even so, the team's defenders insist that no one really cares that this is just political correctness run wild, said Robert McCartney in the Washington Post. Not true. All major Native American organizations have called on sports teams to get rid of Indian names and mascots. Today, there are only 70 high school teams left in the red slur category, down from 500 in 1970. That should tell the team something. Sometimes being politically correct is just plain correct. Now, here are a few short items from the Talking Points section as we close our reading of the Week magazine for this week. The first one, U.S. defense spending soared from $287 billion in 2001 to more than $700 billion in 2010 and 2011, including the supplemental costs for Iraq and Afghanistan. The U.S. currently spends $250 billion more on the military each year than it does on Medicare. Senator Marco Rubio was the subject of mockery after he reached for a water bottle during his response to the State of the Union last week, but his PAC has raised more than $100,000 by selling customized Rubio water bottles to contributors for a minimum of $25 each. Since the liberal detractors, a message that not only does Mark Rubio inspire you, he hydrates you too, said the fundraising pitch. U.S. carbon emissions have fallen to 13% below 2005 levels. The increased use of natural gas instead of coal accounts for 38% of that decline, while the growing use of wind power has contributed 27% of the carbon savings, a new study has shown, and that was written in the Washington Post. A groundbreaking survey of more than 200,000 Americans has found that 3.5% of the population identifies as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. And U.S. Representative Paul Brown, Republican from Georgia, said last week that there are more people killed by baseball bats and hammers than are killed with guns. This is a myth. In 2011, FBI data shows 8,583 people were murdered with firearms. Only 496 people were killed with baseball bats, hammers, and other such objects. And now we'll turn to the poll watch for this week. 64% of American adults say sports figures have a greater influence on society than clergy or other faith leaders. 19% say religious leaders have more influence than athletes. And 7% of Americans say they would definitely volunteer to go on a one-way trip to a Mars colony, even though they could never return to Earth. Another 26% say they'd have to think about it just a little bit before they make their decision. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of the Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.